On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
I'm a horseshoer, so everybody know me when I walk down the street. They know my horses, you know. My typical day, I start off here in the morning, like 3:30 in the morning. I get up, so I go for my run. I come here, I take my stalls and I clean them. Then I also work at another place down the street. I go down there and I have 20 horses to clean after down there. What a day, huh? 20 horses every day. It's like a factory.
That's horseshoer and Compton cowboy Andrew Johnson. We'll talk more about that city's cowboy culture later on the show. But first, Donald Trump is now the established front runner for the Republican presidential nomination after yet another primary win last night in Nevada. He often says he is self-financed, and it's true he has spent some of his own money, around $17 million, but a lot of his money comes from small donors, and he has minimal super PAC support when compared to his rivals. Just look at Jeb Bush. His Right to Rise super PAC raised more than $100 million, far more than any other candidate, but it couldn't get him out of the single digits in most states. So, does this mean the influence of super PACs is overblown? David Frum joins me now. He's senior editor at The Atlantic and a former speechwriter for George W. Bush. His latest article in The Atlantic is called Twilight of the Super PAC. Hi, David.
Hey there.
Twilight of the Super PAC. Is that an overblown headline, or do you really believe they are on the way out?
Well, I don't know that they're on the way out legally, but we can see they're having tremendous difficulty raising funds. Look at the poor performance of Marco Rubio's Conservative Solutions Super PAC. Since January, as Jeb Bush has faded, Marco Rubio has become every donor's favorite. In the month of January, he raised, I think, $2.5 million, which is, you know, a lot of money if you're having a bake sale, but not a lot of money but compared to what Jeb Bush was able to raise.
Mm-hmm. Well, is it a problem of the candidate rather than the amount of money? In other words, is it the candidate who is not connecting? I mean, in the case of Jeb Bush, I guess that's a yes, but also the way that the campaign is spending the money?
I sometimes hang out a little bit with people who write checks to these organizations. And over the past 3 or 4 years, there has been a gathering sense of frustration, exasperation, and even sense of betrayal about both the effectiveness and the quality of management of these institutions. Mm-hmm. These institutions are not very transparent, and they don't tend to be very effective. They're not good at winning elections. And in the article, I make this point. Here's the core problem with the super PAC, that the super PAC is able to take unlimited amounts of funds so long as it doesn't coordinate with the campaign. So the campaign is run by the candidate or the candidate's campaign manager. So the candidate has an interest in spending as little as possible on anything that won't directly advance that candidate getting elected, wants to keep the fees down, wants to keep the cost down. But because the super PAC is separated from the candidate, it ends up being run by consultants for the candidate. And they do not share that same interest in saving every possible dollar. And the result is that super PACs, we don't know a lot about what goes on, but donors have come to suspect that there is a lot of self-dealing going on. These are like, you know, they're like big bloated corporations that don't have good shareholders. Or the analogy I use is they're kind of like hedge funds, where you end up charging above market fees to get below market returns.
Right, and there's no accountability per se, right?
There's no accountability. So I quote in the story that an allegation was published on Sunday night on the CNN website that the director of the Jeb Bush super PAC had collected $14 million for
Mike
himself.
Mike Murphy. Uh-huh.
Yes. Mike Murphy strenuously denied that this was true. And the super PAC itself said, issue the following statement and tell me if you find this reassuring. That charge, they said, cannot be supported because it is impossible that the person who made the charge, who was a bundler for Right to Rise, could have known how we spend our money, because we don't tell anybody how we spend our money. How we spend our money is known only to an internal committee of three. So that person was talking ignorantly. And you think, that's, You know, I'm prepared to, I'll take their word for it if they say it's not true, but it is a funny defense to say, we are not wasting your money. How dare you say so? Because our total lack of transparency means you can't have the knowledge to make that accusation credibly.
So let me just try to tease out exactly what you're saying here. Are you saying that the super PACs are in trouble just because they are bloated, not run efficiently, and not transparent? Or are you saying that this whole idea of super PACs is in trouble? In other words, this idea of large outside spending on these candidates?
Well, I speculate that they may begin to run into a lot of donor resistance. When Bernie Sanders goes out on the campaign trail, he talks about millionaires and billionaires buying democracy. But look, I've hung around them. They are not people, not everybody who writes a big check to a super PAC is pleased to do it. Many of them would rather give to the opera or the homeless shelter or their alma mater or some other cause they've got. But somebody important to them leans on them. They would be oftentimes really happy if there were an external limit that said you can give $25,000 and no more. They'd be really happy about that, but there's no limit, and so they can be squeezed to pay more. And I point out the comparison to what happened after Watergate, where when the campaign laws were first passed in 1974, they were passed with the support of many people who had been donors to the Nixon campaign who testified to Congress that they had felt extorted. And the president of American Airlines was squeezed to pay a quarter of his annual salary to Nixon's reelection. At that time, airfares were regulated by the federal government, by presidential appointees. And he didn't feel he could say no. But boy, would he have liked to have said no. And what then sometimes happened is some of these executives, because the amount they were squeezed for was so much, they found complicated ways to contrive to reimburse themselves from the company treasury, which was very illegal. And some of them got into quite a lot of legal trouble. And those laws passed with the support of some donors. I wonder if there isn't going to be some kind of reaction to that now, where many people are going to feel, looking back on Right to Rise, you know, I was squeezed, I didn't like doing it. I would have appreciated some kind of external limit, and if someone can find a way to put them back, I'll be kind of appreciative.
So this is at the presidential level where we're seeing the trouble with the super PACs. But what about lower down on the political food chain, the congressional races, governor's races, even, you know, local races, local political races? Can super PACs be, you know, largely successful in getting what they want in those races?
They do have a better record lower down. And I think there's a very specific reason for this. The most successful, the network of funds associated with the Koch brothers. Remember, the Koch brothers aren't politicians, so they don't have to worry about, they spend the money as they see fit. They spend their own money their way, and they don't have to worry about coordinating with the campaign. And that means you eliminate some of these self-dealing possibilities that you get when it's a campaign consultant running it. That they can, you know, when people spend their own money more wisely and more frugally than they spend other people's money.
Right. So all in all, is this a good thing for democracy? A lot of people wring their hands at the effect of Citizens United saying it is, you know, subverting democracy. Do you think the pendulum is swinging back?
It's clearly not a good thing for democracy. I mean, in ways very different from the Bernie Sanders critique. It's not a good thing for democracy because supposing Jeb Bush had not been able to raise all of that enormous money, there might have been some other people who stepped forward who might have been credible candidates, and he might have had to step backward. If he had to say, you're not going to start with this giant financial advantage, but you're going to have to, through the regular campaign finance system, fight on more equal terms with the Scott Walkers and the Marco Rubios of this world, that might have dissuaded him, and we can now see that would have been a good thing to do. But as I said, if it ends up that because of the super PAC, we have Donald Trump trample the whole Republican field, that's a very nervous-making thing for democracy.
David Frum, senior editor at The Atlantic and former speechwriter for George W. Bush. You can read his essay, Twilight of the Super PAC, at The Atlantic. David, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, as we just talked about, Donald Trump continues to dominate the GOP race, even without much super PAC money. We'll find out if he's able to keep this momentum going next Tuesday, which is Super Tuesday. Voters from around a dozen states head to the polls then. Joining me now is Reid Wilson, chief political correspondent for the Morning Consult. Hi, Reid.
Hey.
All right. So tell us about the Super Tuesday states. There are a lot of southern states in play, as well as Vermont and Massachusetts. What is at stake next Tuesday?
Well, let's start with the Republican side. At stake is approximately 25% of the total delegates that can be allocated to go to the national convention in Cleveland. 25% of the total delegates means half of the delegates you actually need to win the nomination. So there's a lot at stake right here. It's not likely that we're going to see one campaign rack up a massive number of delegates, because all of these states under the Republican National Committee rules have to allocate their delegates on a proportional basis. That is, based on where you finish in the polls, some people will get some delegates, others will get others. There are no winner-take-all states coming up on Tuesday. The stakes are really highest for Ted Cruz. He's really made the case that he can do the best in these southern states, what they're calling the SEC primary, states like Georgia and Alabama and Texas, his home state, Oklahoma, states with big evangelical populations that are going to essentially be very conservative Republican electorates. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, Donald Trump has been doing well enough that he's leading in the polls in all but two of the states that we've seen any kind of reliable polling on, coming up on Super Tuesday. The only two states where he's not leading, both states where Ted Cruz leads, Texas and Arkansas.
But that's just a slim lead in Texas.
Well, it is, because of the number of delegates that are available, and because of Cruz's organization in Texas, he could still come out of there with a pretty significant result. The point is, Ted Cruz has staked his claim on Super Tuesday. He is going to do well. He is going to build a delegate lead, very likely, over Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, his main rival for sort of that number two spot. Mm-hmm. But the question is, how big a lead can Cruz build? Can he actually catch up with Donald Trump, who leads by almost 60 delegates now in just sort of the raw count after the first four states? And can Cruz build on that momentum going forward to the future? If he doesn't have a good night on Tuesday, if he can't build on that momentum, then you're likely to see Cruz's bid stall. But don't expect him to drop out of the race.
Let's talk about the phenomenon of the evangelical vote. As you said, that's a big portion of the Super Tuesday vote next Tuesday. Trump, though, took home a large portion of that vote in South Carolina. I think he got 34% of evangelicals. Ted Cruz got 26%. Now, what's going on there?
So you can't really consider evangelicals as a monolithic group. I think there are really three dominant groups within the Republican primary these days, and they cut across demographic lines, like evangelicals in men and women and high education, low education, all that kind of stuff. The three main lanes that we can talk about are the change lane. I kind of call that the burn the house down lane. Those are the voters who are so desperate to change Washington, D.C., that they will vote for somebody who is completely outside the system. They love Donald Trump. You've got the values lane, the voters who want to vote for somebody who shares their values, who would bring back a conservative America through ideological and values positions. Those are Ted Cruz voters. Those are the people who particularly love him. And then there are the voters who are thinking about November. Call it the electability lane. In all of these early primaries, you've seen Marco Rubio do best among voters who say they want a candidate who can win in November. So those are really the three lanes that the main candidates are competing for these days. The problem is that Donald Trump sort of owns that change lane. But for Ted Cruz in the values lane, he's got to deal with Ben Carson, who's still taking some votes. And for Marco Rubio in the electability lane, he's got to deal with John Kasich, who's still competing for votes. You mentioned some of the other Super Tuesday states, Massachusetts and Vermont, that will vote. Not very Republican states by any means. They still get to send delegates to Cleveland to elect a nominee. John Kasich is campaigning hard in those states. Any John Kasich delegate from next Tuesday is not a Marco Rubio delegate.
But if you see what's happened in New Hampshire and you look at Vermont and Massachusetts, maybe they could go for Trump.
I think they're totally different states. They could, in fact, go for Trump. And Trump got a huge crowds when he showed up in Western Massachusetts earlier this year, or maybe that was late last year, whenever that was. And you're right. They very well could go for Donald Trump. The point is, though, because these are all proportional states that award delegates based on where these various candidates win in congressional districts and how, what percentage of the vote they get nationally or in you know, at large in any given state, every vote for Kasich, if Kasich is at hypothetically 10% and Rubio is at 15%, that means that Rubio is not at 25%, where assumingly the Kasich voters would then go for Rubio.
One line of argument has been that Donald Trump is doing so well because there were so many people in the race splitting the vote against him, and that once it winnows down to maybe one or two candidates, he won't be doing as well. He disputed that last night in his speech, saying all the voters who would go with the candidates who drop out would go for him. What do you think?
There's no question that Donald Trump has done well because the field is so divided. And you need only look at South Carolina for an example of that. Donald Trump won about 33% of the vote in South Carolina, 10 points ahead of Rubio and Cruz, which is fantastic for him. However, because he won that just 33% in a state that awards delegates proportionally, Trump won every single congressional district, which means that of the 50 delegates that were available in South Carolina, Donald Trump won all 50. So, yes, divided field certainly brings down the percentage of votes that Donald Trump has to get in order to rack up these delegates, you know, hand over fist. The problem for Republicans, though, in the sense, is that Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz are in this sort of prisoner's dilemma. They're both trying to become the most acceptable alternative second-place finisher because they both believe that in a head-to-head matchup against Donald Trump, they can win. Well, when you're trying to run for second place, the person who's the biggest threat to you is not the guy who's in first. It's the guy who's also trying to run for second place. So we've got a situation where Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz are trying to essentially force the other out of the race. And the longer they are fighting over that sort of second place head-to-head against Donald Trump, the longer Donald Trump remains uncontested in first place. Now, 25% of the available delegates getting allocated on Super Tuesday, another quarter or so in the next few weeks in contests on March 5th and then March 15th. The fact is, we're getting to the point at which Trump can't be caught.
Reed Wilson, chief political correspondent for the Morning Consult. Thanks.
You got it.
And we want to hear from you, our California voters. Are you frustrated that you have to wait until June to make a difference at the ballot box? Let us know. 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the show, there are new plans to build a big new equestrian center in Compton. The city has a rich history of horseback riding. We'll talk about the Compton Cowboys next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. L.A. County supervisors have voted to renovate Magic Johnson Park in South L.A. The park is near Compton. It's 104 acres, and the county plans to spend $135 million making it over. Some residents are unhappy about part of that plan, which calls for a new equestrian center. They say they don't want to live next door to horses, even though Compton has a long history as a horse town, a history that continues through today. Right in the middle of the Rough City, immortalized by NWA, Compton's historic agricultural district is alive and well. Trey Hosley grew up in Compton riding horses. Now he's one of the subjects of an upcoming documentary called Fire on the Hill, the story of the Compton Cowboys. Welcome to the program, Trey.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. And Rachel Searles joins us as well. She's an advisor for the UC Cooperative Extension, which studies LA's agricultural history. Hi there.
Hi, how are you, Madeline?
I'm great. So, Trey, let's start with you. You're 22 years old now. You're a professional rodeo rider, and you spoke at the Board of Supervisors meeting yesterday. What did you say?
Really, I was just there to stress, you know, how things would go if this wasn't put into place. You know, this is an area that's been, you know, vaguely infected and, you know, had to deal with gang violence and drugs and things of the sort. And I just kind of wanted to stress my story and let the officials know that it is possible to get kids out from Compton into things other than you know, football, basketball, mm-hmm. and academics, you know, because as a kid growing up, that was what I thought were the only ways.
How did you start riding horses?
I've actually always been around horses. My grandfather's from Mississippi, and whenever he moved down here, he's got 8 sons, so he kind of kept horses around, and my dad was the one son that stayed semi in horses, so I've been around horses forever, but I actually was a football player for most of my life, all the way up through my first semester of college, and there got to a point where I just knew I needed to do something different, and I needed to give, you know, that passion to something other than football. And, I mean, rodeo just was perfect. It fit me well.
So. And so do you go around the country going
to
rodeos?
Yes, I've actually been all over the U.S. from California to Texas. I college rodeoed in Texas on a scholarship. I've been as far as Washington, D.C. for rodeos. So I've been some of everywhere, yeah, definitely.
And, Rachel, let's bring you in to talk about the history of this area and why it has such a strong history of horseback riding. And Compton has an agricultural history. So tell us about that.
Yes, it does. I've been working for several years now on this great project on the history of farming in Los Angeles County. And as we sort of look at the history of farming around LA, we keep coming back to Compton because there was so much that happened in Compton over the years. It was part of one of the original ranchos of Los Angeles County that was sort of the very history of the area and its farming. And then later, it was a colony formed by Methodists who were into temperance and not drinking. And later, it became part of this movement called the Small Farm Home Movement, where suburbs all around Los Angeles were created for people who moved to Los Angeles specifically to have a little tiny farm that they could call their own. And this was very active from about 1910 to about 1930 or 40.
And Trey, would that be your dad, your grandfather, who was part of the Small Farm Home movement?
Oh, I don't think my grandfather ever moved out here until the late 2000s. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So he was a horseman before he moved out to Compton?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. So, Rachel, there were a lot of agricultural zones in the LA area, and they are no longer agriculturally zoned. Why does Compton still have that zoning?
Well, that's a great question, Madeline. First of all, I just want to, if you don't mind, can I read an advertisement that I found from a 1911 LA Times about Richland Farms?
Yes,
and
please.
Why people were so interested in it. It says, let us show you our demonstration acre, proving the exceptional productiveness of Richland Farms soil. Vegetables, chickens, and a cow or two should net close to $600 per year on a Richland Farms acre. Here is your last opportunity to buy income-producing acreage with all city conveniences at $650 per acre, one-third cash, balance easy payments. So,
sounds like a great deal.
Folks,
yeah,
wanted these. I know, seriously. Folks wanted these little tiny pocket-sized farms that were 1 to 3 acres because they were coming from other parts of the U.S. that were agricultural and rural, but they wanted to keep their farming lifestyle. And I think what's so unique about Richland Farms is that all these other places around the county, for the most part, have been paved over, they've been built out, and Richland Farms remains. So the question is why? And I think the reason is because so many people live in Richland Farms that love their horses and enjoy that sort of country lifestyle that they've protected it, whereas in other parts of the county, that interest faded away in the 1950s and 1960s, and that's when we saw most agricultural land being paved over.
Hmm, interesting. Well, Trey, what do you see out there? Do you see young people following? Well, you're still really young, but do you see other young people following in your footsteps, being interested in riding horses?
Well, actually, every time I approach a group of young kids, let's say I ride a horse to the park or something of the sort, they actually love it. But the sad part that I'm starting to realize is that a lot of kids outside of the Richland Farms, I mean, literally in Compton, 5, 6, 7 blocks away, know nothing about the horses. You know, like they're like, oh, well, I saw a horse riding down Greenleaf a few months ago and I just thought nothing of it. Well, you know, like they thought it was something just, you know, it was something extraordinary. Yeah. But I'm actually trying to show more kids, you know, like, I mean, because I made a lifestyle of this. Like, I don't have a job. I'm a professional rodeo athlete. This is all I do. And I'd like for more kids to be able to do things of this sort. So I'm in the process of reaching out to kids and trying to get them to see that there is more than football, basketball, track, and gangs and drugs. So.
And is there a rodeo in Compton?
Not yet, but we're working on that. I'm actually working on putting on a roping for like elementary school kids just to spark their interest, you know, kind of get them in this environment and introduce them to others.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And would there be a place to have a rodeo?
Oh, well, Magic Johnson now. Yeah. But until that's done, we'll have to improvise the location. But
so that might be part of the new renovations.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so, Rachel, what about agriculture? Is it still a big farming area?
Well, I would call Richland Farms more like a quasi-farming area. A lot of residents there, and Richland Farms is like it's sort of a 10-block area neighborhood. A lot of people have retained their, you know, their large lot. And not built it out. So you see people with big gardens, with a couple of cows, maybe some goats, oftentimes horses. So it's sort of more like a hobby farm kind of thing. It's mm-hmm. a lifestyle thing. People like having horses and they like having a garden because oftentimes it reminds them of where they grew up or where they were raised.
Rachel Searles is an advisor for the UC Cooperative Extension and studies LA's agricultural history. Trey Hosley is a professional rodeo rider from Compton. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the setting for an Agatha Christie-like murder story is not in a drawing room, but on the wild Farallon Islands off the coast of California, a place not meant for humans.
We have a great illusion as human beings that we are outside of nature somehow. And I don't think that's true. I think that we still are animals. We still are of the ecosystem. We still are on the food chain.
I'll speak with the author of a new novel, The Lightkeepers, next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for handpicked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download it for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles can be a harsh place to live. Traffic, rapidly exploding rents, $5 lattes, but really our greatest natural predator is the Tesla-driving road rager on the 101. On the Farallon Islands, though, a mere 30 miles off the coast of San Francisco, everything is trying to kill you. The crumbling, porous granite cliffs, bloodthirsty sharks, murderous seagulls, and living with that constant threat of natural violence, well, it takes a toll on one's sense of civilization. The Farallon Islands are something of a main character in writer Abby Jeaney's new novel. It's called The Lightkeepers, and it tells the story of Miranda, a nature photographer and a group of biologists who live on the Farallon Islands. Abby Jeaney, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you just paint this incredibly foreboding picture of this island chain. You know, ships can't dock anywhere near the islands without crashing. These animals seem and are bloodthirsty. one ends up killing one of your characters.
Yes.
What attracted you to the Farallon Islands, and why did you want to set your novel there?
Well, I knew I wanted to write a mystery in which, you know, in the style of sort of Agatha Christie, those golden era mysteries where there's an enclosed situation and a limited group of suspects and a suspicious death. You know, in Agatha Christie's time, it was, you know, the butler with the tea. But it's hard to do that in today's day and age. So I was sort of looking for the right setting for a long time for this mystery that I had in my head. And then I read a memoir called The Devil's Teeth, written by Susan Casey, about the Farallon Islands. And in addition to wanting to write a mystery, I love to write about the natural world. I just find it so inspiring and strange, and, you know, truth is stranger than fiction. So once I'd read this incredible memoir about this just amazing place, I had my setting for the story I wanted to tell.
So Miranda, your main character, she decides that this is the place where she wants to live for a while, and she's been traveling the world taking pictures. She is still dealing with the death of her mother that happened when she was a young child. And so she's a footloose wanderer, and she lives on these islands with half a dozen or so other footloose wanderers. And tell us a little bit more about her and what it is that she wants to get out of living in this bleak place.
The previous book that I wrote was a short story collection. And when I was reading reviews of the short story collection, people kept saying that I was writing stories about grief and loss and the recovery from grief. And that was not a theme I had been aware of in writing it. But I realized that that's a story that has a lot of pull for me. So in this story, I wanted to explicitly talk about what it means to be a person who has suffered a terrible loss, to have had a person in their life who has vanished, and to be trying to recover from grief. And so for Miranda, that's the emotional journey that I wanted her to go on, among others, on the islands was, you know, her mother has died. Her mother died in a senseless accident. How do we make sense of what an accident is? How do we recover from that kind of loss? How do we, you know, find ourselves?
Mm. Yeah, and there are a couple of accidents, maybe one
yes.
is not an accident, involving the people.
Yes.
We'll just
yes,
let
I'm
it
try. I don't want to give
there.
Away any spoilers,
yeah,
but
yeah.
yes, there are.
Let's just say it doesn't take place in the drawing room with the candlestick.
No.
Okay. So she is a nature photographer, the ultimate observer, and mm-hmm. she's never interfering. She's only documenting. And is that basically a metaphor for you?
Interesting. I think initially I wanted her to be an outsider. So I wanted her to come to the islands where only biologists and research and scientists live. And the reason for her to go was that she's a photographer. But a way that I access my characters' minds is to research what they know. And so she knows a lot about photography. So I did a lot of research about photography. And the more I did that, the more she became a clear character to me. I guess I did, yes, find connections between the photographer and the writer. You know, the writer is the person who watches something happen and then takes it home and makes a story out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference, of course, is that a photographer does that in the moment. You know, that's a thing that I don't think I could do. I need time to process it and think about it and let it simmer before I can tell the story, whereas a photographer right there in that second has to reach for the camera and make art out of it.
She ends up taking a picture of herself, which she rarely does, and finds out something about herself, something really, really important.
Very covertly said.
Yes. And, you know, not to stretch the metaphor too far, but what did you find out about yourself writing this novel?
I started writing the novel. I knew that she was writing letters to her mother, and I couldn't figure out why the book seemed to want to come out that way. I kept trying to write it different ways that would be easier, because writing an epistolary novel from a character who's writing to another character is difficult. And I think as I was writing it, I began to understand why the book wanted to be told that way, why this character wanted to write the story that way, and how I myself, I think, can learn to recover from the grief that I've experienced in my own life the same way that she does through these letters and through the stories that she tells to her mother that she doesn't tell to anyone else.
What is the grief that you're talking about?
In my own life?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's less that I've suffered a terrible trauma and more that I think all of us have archetypal stories that kind of speak to us, and they come out in a kind of dream language where sometimes I need to write stories about grief and the recovery from grief because that's how I process things in my own life, even if that's not a direct line to how those things occurred. Like, she's writing about the death of her mother. Both my parents are living and are really wonderful people. But writing that story about her loss helped me understand other losses in my own life. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And appropriately mysterious as well.
Okay.
So this is a very primal, brutal place. And does that mean that humans, when they live in a place like that, they revert to some of their primal urges?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I think that our primal urges are always there. I think that we are animals and we have not outgrown our essential nature. I think that it's possible that in that kind of place where there's less of what I would consider to be the illusion of civilization, our true nature emerges. But I don't know that we revert or become anything different than what we already are.
But does it highlight things that perhaps wouldn't come to the fore anywhere else? I mean, what are you saying about civilization, quote-unquote?
We have a great illusion as human beings that we are outside of nature somehow and that we're no longer animals. We've evolved past that. We are something else now. And I don't think that's true. I think that we still are animals. We still are of the ecosystem. We still are on the food chain. And I think that the civilization that we live in is a lovely illusion that makes us all feel safe and makes us all feel, you know, contained within this nice bubble that we've built. But I'm more interested in the places where human beings and nature collide outside of that. And I think the Farallon Islands are a wonderful example of what it's like when we no longer have that illusion. There is no civilization there. There is no safety there.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Abby Jeanney. She's written a new novel. It's called The Lightkeepers. And it takes place on the Farallon Islands, which are a chain of islands off the coast of San Francisco, a chain of islands that is uninhabited. And you tell a little history, the real history of the Farallons in your book. And I wonder if you could tell us more about the eggers, the people during the gold rush who went out to these islands to rob the birds of their eggs.
Oh, it's such an interesting story. And they weren't the only ones who went out there and just devastated the animal life. People hunted the seals and, you know, wreaked havoc on the environment there. But the eggers were particularly interesting to me because, so this was San Francisco, you know, right during the height of the gold rush. And they'd come there to San Francisco to find gold, which, of course, they weren't necessarily finding. But there were no eggs. There were no chickens in San Francisco at that time. And they had heard about the Farallon Islands, which were, you know, 30 miles away across this incredibly dangerous stretch of water. And they would go there in these, you know, rickety boats and just take all of the mer eggs. The mers were the birds that dominated the islands at that time. They would have egg shirts where they could carry 200 eggs, I think, on one man. And they would just take and take and take and take. And the birds have still to this day not recovered from the devastation that was wreaked on them by these guys.
But why weren't there eggs on the mainland? Why weren't there chickens?
Just because they, you know, it was a frontier time and they hadn't made it out there yet. Yeah, the chickens hadn't come. Nobody had thought to bring any chickens. So they were there with nothing, no eggs and nothing that could be made with eggs. And one guy, his name was Doc Robinson, suddenly thought, ooh, you know, I can't have any gold, but eggs, that could make me some money. And so he went to the Farallon Islands and a bunch of other people followed him. And things got really violent. I mean, they were really serious about harvesting these eggs. There were people who, you know, were having gun battles on the islands. And there was a story that I heard about people who, some of the eggers went into a cave to try and hide from another group of them. And the cave was toxic because it was filled with guano. And they refused to leave even as they began dying because they were just so determined to continue to rob the islands.
Wow. So then there are also people there, the Lightkeepers.
Yes.
And you've named your novel The Lightkeepers. Tell us about the Lightkeepers. They're sort of the foil to the eggers.
Yes. Well, the Farallon Islands they were called the Devil's Teeth. They were called the Islands of the Dead. They're just a terrible marine hazard. You cannot see them. They're in the middle of nowhere. The seas are rough and wild. There's tides and currents. And so ships would just crashing and burning. There are so many wrecks around there. And so the government decided to build a lighthouse, finally, around the same time that the Eggers were there. And so they sent a work crew over, and it was so difficult. I mean, you can't dock there. You can't bring supplies onto the it's just too dangerous. You can barely get yourself onto the shore. So they had to, you know, mine the materials that they needed out of the islands themselves, and they built the lighthouse. And then people had to live in this dangerous place to tend the lighthouse and to keep the ship safe. And I love that idea of, you know, they didn't take from the land any more than they needed. They didn't devastate the Eggs and the Murs and the way that the Eggers were. They were just there to keep the light. And I thought about the biologists who are there now, and there really are these researchers who live in this wild, dangerous place, and they're there to protect the animals and to study the animals, and they don't do any harm to the place. And so it seemed like there was a direct line between the lightkeepers of old and the biologists who are there now.
So Miranda, she leaves, and that's not mm-hmm. giving it away because you open the book with her leaving.
Yes.
Is she an Egger or a lightkeeper?
That's a good question. I think that I wanted her to be a lightkeeper, and I wanted her to think of herself that way. But I think that most readers will leave the book with their own impression, and I think it's up for debate. And that was one of the questions I wanted to leave in the hands of the reader when I was done.
But it doesn't have to be either or, does it? I mean, she could be both.
Yes, she could. And she can be a lightkeeper to me forever because I love her. And other people can think differently.
Well, Abby Genie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That's Abby Genie. Her new novel is called The Lightkeepers. And keeping the light on at 1 o'clock, Warren Olney is here. Hello.
What a nice way to be introduced. Thank you very much for that. Our light today will shine on Marco Rubio. We're doing a series of candidate profiles, and we've gotten to the first-term senator from Florida who says he is ready to go to the White House. And he has a very interesting career, meteoric rise in Florida politics. Maybe he has a record in the U.S. Senate. There's some dispute about that. His relationship with Jeb Bush, of course, is absolutely fascinating.
Right.
And we'll hear about all of that and what it has meant for Florida. A lot of people in Florida think that Jeb Bush will still probably get more votes for president than Marco Rubio, even though Jeb Bush has officially left the race.
Interesting. And Donald Trump might get more than both of them.
Well, that's quite possible.
Okay, Warren Olney, and To the Point coming up at 1 o'clock. Thank you. And coming up on this program, 5 fixes, maybe 6, for Hollywood's color and gender problem next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Oscar nominations are, once again, shining a spotlight on the lack of diversity in Hollywood. Not surprisingly, the author of a damning new report by USC Annenberg calls the business a straight white boys club. The question is, what can really be done about it? Variety asked a lot of people that question and printed a 5-point plan called Oscar and Diversity, 5 Ways to Fix Hollywood's Imbalance. Tim Gray of Variety is here to talk about it. Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thanks. Well, the Oscars, let's be honest here, they're the end of the process, of the long process here. So is it a little unfair to be shining the spotlight on them when the problem starts at the beginning of making a movie?
I mean, I think shining a spotlight on them is okay. I think pointing a finger at them is a little not okay, because it really is, for better and for worse, the Academy reflects the Hollywood film industry. And it's like, that's really where the problem is, because there were like 300 films eligible this past year for Oscars. And if films really reflected the population of the U.S., we'd be talking about like 80 films. We're talking about like maybe 4 films, you know,
right.
I mean, Creed and Beasts of No Nation. And it's like, okay, so something's wrong, that there's not enough possibilities there for the Oscar voters. And also, they keep the results a secret. So it's like, you want to know, I mean, I loved Straight Outta Compton, but it's like, okay, did that miss out by one vote, or did it only get one vote? You know, so it's like that kind of maybe would have shed some light on what's going on in the Academy.
Okay, so let's go down your list. Number one, you say investors need to be educated, and you're saying it's not just the studios and agents that are the problems, but really the people who invest in these projects.
Actually, the TV industry is relatively diverse, in terms of races, gender mix. I mean, it's not where it should be, but it's much better. But the film business is so cautious. It's all based on past successes, so it becomes self-fulfilling. So they do studies, and it's like, okay, this film had two white Caucasian males, so let's do that with the next film. And so it becomes self-fulfilling. It's like they keep making the same variations of the same movie. That's where you get so many franchises, so many sequels, so many remakes. It's like they want to go with safe stuff, and safe stuff doesn't really reflect the population.
But who's got to do the educating of the investors?
I think the studios and the agencies have to work on that. But I also think like an independent filmmaker needs to gather data and just say, because everybody knows that, you know, Star Wars is a big success. But it's like, okay, gather data on films like Juno, which was centered on a teenage girl, you know, not the traditional movie, or The Help. And those movies are actually much more profitable compared to the investment and the return on investment. They didn't earn $1 billion because that's people always think in terms of like billions. Is this going to get the four quadrant audience, as they say?
So the filmmaker in your second recommendation, you say, shouldn't wait for Hollywood to give them the green light. They should be making their own movies and finding their own financing. These are minority and women filmmakers.
Yeah, I thought that was a kind of a depressing point, but really smart, because he used Ava DuVernay as an example, because she's a self-starter. She's making the kind of movies she
who's
wants.
Who's he? Wait, hang on. Who's he?
Oh, David Magdio, who's a public relations expert. He's a very smart guy. And so he was talking about this because, you know, Variety started in 1905. We have stories going back decades where people were asking for better representation of minorities and women. I mean, stories from the 60s, from the 70s, where people issued reports saying, you know, that Hollywood hiring is not as diverse as it should be. And, you know, the pessimist in me says, you know, if it hasn't happened now, you know, it may not happen. So don't bank on the studios suddenly becoming enlightened. Just do it yourself. And there are films like last year's Tangerine, which was shot on an iPhone. And it's like, you know, that returned its investment many times over. So it's like, okay, you can find an audience and you can find success by going your own route.
Yeah, I think you could put that film on your credit card.
Yeah, exactly. And that may be the solution. I mean, again, the whole idea of Hollywood diversity is I kind of think, look, in the long run, the studios, it's to their advantage to have films represent the population because, you know, people are going to films less and less. And at some point, you know, Latino audiences and black audiences who are disproportionately large moviegoers, at some point they're going to say, I'm tired of this. You know, I want to go see our own films. And they're going to give up on the Hollywood stuff.
Third point, it seems a little vague, but unarguable. Executives must make a commitment.
Well, it's like a really important point, but it is vague. I mean, it's very easy to say, oh, no, we're really committed to diversity hiring, but they really have to work on it. I talked to some HR people talking about the hiring process, and they said, you know, what often happens is you go through the usual channels and, you know, everybody in the 21st century, you're so distracted that you tend to take the shortcut. And it's like if you have a new position open and you think, okay, let's try and get somebody of a different race. Let's try and get a woman in here. Let's try this. And then, you know, a friend of a friend who works with you says, oh, my God, my friend would be perfect for it. You think, okay, that's easier because I got to get back to my work. But it really does require a long-term commitment to really be patient, hire the right person. It has to be the right person because you're not doing them any favor if you're hiring a minority person who's not perfect for the job. But, you know, it may require a little bit of extra time to find that person.
So number four, Hollywood needs to create support systems. And number five, People need to change the way you define diversity. What do you mean by that?
You know, it's great to hire somebody in an entry-level position, but Joe Hall of the Ghetto Film School said, you know, those people often have trouble moving to the next step. And so it's like you got to do mentoring in long term. And all in terms of diversity, it's various races, it's women. You know, I mean, the population is very mixed and interesting, and it's got to reflect that.
You know, I know somebody who's trying to get a TV project made, and they're trying to find a director for this project. And the person who is helping shepherd this through keeps saying, you need to have a name, you need to have a name, you need to have a name in order to get it through, to get the studios to produce it, to get the money, etc. And, you know, that seems to be sort of a, you know, vicious circle, because the names are or have been largely white men.
No, exactly. And this is, you know, again, my column is like, here's some concrete things, but it's all very long term, because to say, okay, let's put all these five proposals in motion and then next year's Oscars, we're going to see a big change. It's like, yeah, it's not going to happen that fast, because, again, people are resistant, especially in the film industry, because it's all based on past successes and on track record, and you need somebody involved. Like every once in a while, you'll see a film, you know, Martin Scorsese presents, and it'll be like a foreign film that's getting a release. And it's like he just, you know, believed in the film. He lent his name to it, but he didn't direct it. But, you know, you need some kind of marquee person working with you on this.
So maybe one of your points should also be that the marquee people need to step up and help the non-marquee people.
That's an excellent point.
Now you have a six-point plan.
Exactly. Well, you know, unfortunately, this conversation is not going to go away. I think it's going to get very loud in the next few days until the Oscars happen. But you know, I don't think it's going to go away, and I don't think it should go away. This should be an ongoing thing. So hopefully I'll be writing more columns. But I think the marquee names is a good point.
Tim Gray, awards editor of Variety. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
And Jolie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hi.
Hello. You mean Jolie Myers presents the feedback?
You're making it happen.
So we just talked about voting for the Oscars. We also talked about voting for the president today.
We did.
And we talked about the fact that Super Tuesday is coming up, but our Super Tuesday isn't coming up until June. The California primary is in June, which is nearly dead
light
last.
Light years.
The world could change by then. And we wanted to let our listeners vent their frustration with that process. You know how I love
You like a good vent.
I do. A good rant. I collect them. Mike McGill on Facebook says that the party nominees are all but decided by the time California's primary rolls around. It's like how the winner of the presidential general election is announced through the media before our polls have closed. Way to make me feel completely insignificant. So the problems go beyond. Adam Badlato says, the whole thing is so infuriating. Most of the delegates will already have been assigned before we even go out to vote. How is that fair? He was calling for a national primary, so all of our votes count the same.
All right. I like it. Jolie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
And we'd love to hear from you. Anything you want to talk about, Twitter at KCRW Press Play, Facebook, same thing, KCRW Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.